As usual, could we begin by introducing ourselves? Would you, my name is Greg.
Craig.
Karen.
Jerome.
Kathy.
Russell.
Kate.
Judy.
Todd.
Marie.
Cliff.
Mike. Welcome, everyone. It's been a quiet week and an eventful week in my hometown. It's not Lake Wobegon, it's Jikoji, a little temple in the mountain. And eventful, I think, in this whole country. I feel quite emotionally full and drained and, if I might say, relieved. And it's been quite a week with the election and interesting time, and to feel a kind of flush of history very immediately with us. Sometimes we forget that we're making history, we're making time together, and when big events happen, then we kind of recollect that that's so. Also at Jikoji, lots of comings and goings and things. So I thought today, rather than present a topic of any kind that we could kind of just come back home to our practice and talk together a bit about practice itself. And I would like to invite us all to kind of make this a kind of open forum. We have a Dokusan room, a room of the meeting with a teacher and a student or fellow students meet to inquire and discuss their practice together. When they meet, sometimes a question comes up like, how's it going? Or, what is your practice experience? Very intimate affair, I think. So I'm wondering if, in this situation, we can maybe discuss this together. How's it going with you? What is your experience in practice? Do you have anything that you would like to share, or you have any question comes up?
One thing I wanted to mention, I think it's Veterans Day today. I think that came out of the Second World War, but as far as I know, Greg may be the only veteran here.
To Greg.
I wasn't in the Second World War.
Nevertheless, you survived.
Which war were you in?
I was really lucky. I voluntarily enlisted although there was a draft at that time. It was exactly the period sort of like after the Korean War and before the Vietnam War. And so it was 4 years of relative peace.
Thank you. That's good.
Yeah. It's interesting that we when for the last hour and a half or so we've been facing a wall. It's called Mempeki, wall facing way or wall facing practice. We come from our very involved situation of selfing, you could say, of making a self, of the great, wonderful drama of me, starring me, all about me, and the world according to me, my life, my thoughts, my relationships, my story, a great production. And for a while, at least, for this little time that we have together to sit, we conspire to stop it, to stop, or at least to pause for a time to and see what happens. Colvin said that when we come to the wall, we stop, and that the wall is like we sit upright. It's good posture, and we become the wall. Our mind becomes the wall. So it's basically a wall meets a wall. But there's sometimes there's other things in there as well. Have you noticed?
Yeah, I can say I've never turned into a wall. I haven't reached that point yet.
How did Bodhidharma say it? He said, set aside all affairs, still all conditions, inside no coughing and no sighing. Make the mind a wall, and thus enter the way. Set aside all affairs. Set aside all this for the time being. Set aside all this, all your projects, let's say. Still all those conditions that are agitating you or making you off balance. Still them. Make them still. And inside, no coughing and no sighing. This is interesting, isn't it? No coughing. The way it's been explained to me is this is coughing is like I can't meet this. I have a judgment against this. Excuse me. You kind of separate yourself. And sign is like, I can't meet this. I'm hopeless. I'm a hopeless case. So Bodhidharma says, no, don't do that. Don't presume that you can't meet this, either from the sense of pride or from the sense of lack of self-worth. You just meet it, and you make your mind like the wall. And thus enter the way.
I brought this up with Cliff last week after his talk, and one of the things that has been resonating with me on that talk is he talked about it being at rest, finally almost at rest. That's what I took from it, and been reading.
What at rest? Experience?
Sitting, yeah. I believe. I've been reading a book by a famous guy who started the sleep center in Stanford, and he talks about, and also I've been wrestling with Prajna Paramita, what that is. I don't read Buddhist scripture or anything, and I really like the practice of sitting against the wall, and so anyway, but I've been reading this book, and talks a lot about sleep and REM sleep in particular, and the nervous system. And during REM sleep, apparently, the mind is found when all the senses are shut down for the most part. We actually are in a semi-temporary state of paralysis, and the mind, through a part of the brain in the back, actually starts to become more activated and generate itself and showers the brain, higher functions of the brain, to incite dreams and so forth. So it's self-motivating in a sense. Or but here in the waking state, what seemed kind of curious to me is that we actually, and he says that in the waking state, the brain is actually activated, the nervous system is actually activated because of primarily our five senses. So here, what I, after reading that and listening to Cliff a little bit about that, I realized that in many ways we, this situation here, this condition is to dampen the senses. Low light, being very quiet, and the sitting, I find, and some of what you said about the stillness and the coughing was that, in fact, I find not to literally cough when I feel like I want to cough. And I don't know where that came from, but sensing just what that sensation is, and just letting it, feeling it in a way, and rather than immediately acting on it, like my knees or whatever, just cramps or whatever, and that the fly in my ear, but I let that kind of be, and it deepens something. So anyway, coming back to this sense of dampening things, I'm finding what he said about REM sleep, but then in the waking state, I'm not as, my senses aren't as activated here, specifically, against the wall. But I'm not asleep. So, what happens then? I'm reading the sutra, and this remember Karen saying Prajna Paramita is before knowing. I don't know if that makes any sense, but right now it's the best I can do.
The senses themselves are not necessarily in meditation. It's usually not recommended to dampen or suppress any sensate experience. In fact, the meditation experience itself is designed, you could say, to actually make the understanding or receptivity of the senses more accurate or more precise. So And the Buddha said that he was confronted with someone who had many questions about the philosophical questions about the beginnings of things and whether there was life after death and so on. He refused to answer those. And this person named Bahaya asked, said to Buddha, well, is there... Does the Buddha have no view at all? And the Buddha said, basically, the view of the Buddha is the view of the senses just as they are. That he said, within hearing, he said, Bahaya, please practice this way. Within hearing, let there be just hearing. Within seeing, let there be just seeing. Within cognizing, thinking, let there be just thinking. And within perception itself, let there be just perception. When for you, Bahaya, there is just the seeing within the seeing, the hearing within the hearing, the cognizing within the cognizing, the perceiving within the perceiving, then there will be no here, no there, and no in between. And that, Bahaya, will be the end of suffering. There'll be no separation, basically.
So no taste, no touch, no smell, no object of mind.
What we just chanted before?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. No taste, no touch, no object of mind.
Well, it seems like it's naming the five senses.
It's also naming all the sort of functionings within our experience. The Heart Sutra does, yeah. And basically saying that within hearing, there's also non-hearing. Within seeing, there's also non-seeing. Within knowing, there's also non-knowing. So please practice that this way.
Is this pointing towards the Prajna Paramita technique? Or?
Not really technique, no. Talking about shunyata, about emptiness, the emptiness or the boundlessness or the of all existence is what it talks about. So right now this is an easy way to understand it. Right now I'm talking to you and I'm making sounds, right? The words are coming out. In order for you to understand words as words, you have to ignore the emptiness of words. You have to ignore the silence. You have to actually not pay attention to the silence and focus on the words in order to understand what I'm doing. But in order to understand the truth of words and to come to the completion of words or sound, you have to, what the Heart Sutra is saying, you come to the reality of words without words, of words and no words together. In other words, in a very mundane sense, words and silence together make words, right? You can understand that. And that's true of all existence. It's totally interdependent. So that's what the Heart Sutra, that's what we just chanted, is talking about. But emptiness itself, you know, is kind of the shunyata or emptiness that's talked about in that sutra, and the Mahayana Sutra is very expansive. It's very It's very vast. Did you have something, Judy?
Well, it kind of triggered when you say words and no words. It's like without silence, you can't have sound. Without sound, you can't have silence. Absolutely.
Interdependent. Yeah.
So maybe.
And the truth is that we need to ignore, you could say we need to ignore, or we're in the habit of ignoring, or it's our routine to ignore the silence. But we can actually taste the silence and the words as one, or appreciate the silence with words, or the words with silence. Because so that's the invitation of the Prajna Paramita.
They can't. Doesn't seem to function without it.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's the invitation, heart, to experience. For me.
The invitation.
I mean, I get it, but I don't. Maybe I get it and don't know I get it.
Something like that. I'm not.
The interesting thing, you know, we're talking about practice or trying to talk about practice together, and these kind of questions are good. And in the midst of inquiring, we have to remember that this particular practice is the practice is not, how to say it, it's not like we're being chauffeured around by Buddhism or by the truth or by the way. It's not like getting on a bus and someone else is driving. We're the driver. This is our vehicle right here. This cushion. Have you noticed there's a little steering wheel in front? It actually looks like this. And we have to steer our way. In other words, I think all of us would like to be driven, or like to be told what to do, or like to have mommy and daddy take care of us again, you know, and not have the responsibility of our life. And there's some forms of meditation that are more guided. They're applied to a topic, or someone guides you, and that's wonderful at a certain instance. But this particular way of meditation is that this particular style of meditation is that all of us have to be absolutely responsible for our practice. We have to be an adult. We have to actually come forward and take on the aspiration and job of meeting ourselves at the wall. And it's, you know, it's not easy, because we'd rather be taken care of. But our actually coming to meet the wall like this is actually our courage, you could say, to coming to meet ourselves. Because what do when we meet the wall, when we come and sit? We have to sit with our own body and our own mind, and we have to take responsibility for our mental state. Not too tight and not too loose. Upright, but not tense. We have to be present. We have to arrive. We actually have to be an adult. We have to grow up on this seat. That's the kind of invitation of practice. And of course, it's hard work. Goodness.
Well, see, I don't understand about meeting myself, because when I sit there, just all these things come up, you know, all these thoughts about everything, and then I'm like, no, this is about the breath. So I just go back to the breath, because that's what has helped me so much. But I don't that's all. It's like this constant thing, like the thoughts come up, back to the breath. And so I'm just like, you know, it's a constant thing. It's like every other breath that I have to bring myself back to the breath. And I'm like, what, am I the only one that does this?
I'm really happy you said that. I feel so much more comfortable that you have the same experience I do.
I'm so glad to hear that. I'm thinking, I'm just like a loser over there. I'm sighing inside every time. That's cool.
Does someone have like to respond to that?
You said that. Did you know other people would agree with you?
I didn't have to know, because Abijah acts like, you know, he just drops into this meditation and it's all good. And I'm like, that's not what I experienced. So I'm afraid to say anything to anybody. But now it's like, this is about your practice. What do you experience? Well, let me just say, this is not what I'm not meeting myself with that wall. I'm meeting my constant, you know, admonishment to go back to the breath. So,
well, that was very courageous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to say what came to mind when I heard your statement, Todd, and basically, well, I guess it happened quite a few times for me for today, where I was doing exactly what you're doing, and then, I don't know, it seems like almost suddenly, the wall is there. I mean, I can see it very clearly, and the birds are suddenly there. Suddenly there's an airplane. So it's like all the senses are suddenly on. So I guess I thought that's probably a good thing. So I don't know, that's what I thought of when you said that, is that, you know, having an experience of suddenly being aware of.
Really aware.
And it doesn't necessarily last very long. But it's so, I think senses coming on is...
Yeah, I don't think that's what I meant, but I think you're right. I didn't mean by buffering that the senses are shut down. I do sense my more acute, all of them. But in a certain way, what you just said, which is that I'm aware of them, and so therefore I don't cling to them. And so if there's something else that's happening, it seems, and that's what I was kind of comparing with the way the brain apparently works in REM sleep, but I'm not asleep. So,
well, we set up a situation that's different from our ambulatory life, you could say. We actually set up what might be called a arbitrary or artificial situation here. We actually make things as simple as possible. So meeting this wall, you know, and have you noticed there's no murals on the wall? Or it's usually just a blank wall.
I create my own.
Yeah, I've done that. And we create a silent situation, so we sit still. So we're actually arbitrarily, you say, it's a kind of setup. We set up a very simple situation.
Still conditions,
exactly. And then we see what happens. We see what happens with what arrives. And usually if we're practicing somewhat at all, we actually notice that a body arrives and consciousness arrives. So there are the contents of consciousness, you know, your thoughts. But we can also notice consciousness itself, that we are conscious, you know, beyond the contents of it, beyond this, you know, the flutterings of thoughts or the little trains of thoughts. And we can notice that this is a body and it's located in a room and it's such and such, it's upright. And it seems kind of stupid, you know, or so elemental that why bother just doing that? Everybody does that, right? But to actually get down to that bottom level before thought or before the ambulatory busyness of body itself and notice body just as body and mind just as mind is actually I propose, and I, and the practice, the whole practice tradition proposes that that's actually very good for us. That's very healing, refreshing for us. Yeah,
that's what I sensed of what Kent Cliff said about rest finally. It's, you know, it's a kind of paradox because your kind of senses are kind of heightened, and yet on one hand, and yet because of that, because it's conditions, you're more aware of it, and then I'm able to not grasp to it, and it's like I, my unconsciousness thinking, feeling my back, they're not as if I'm as readily activated, they're like in a certain way relaxed for me to be able to observe them, and so I can let it go, and it almost as if my nervous system is settles, my mind starts to settle.
It settle. It can settle. It can settle, yeah. Or it can relax because it's stable, yeah. Right? It's stable, and it's stable. Why? Why would you say it's stable?
Well, partly because of the conditions in some way. That's kind of what I'm getting at, I think. To set up these conditions with in hope and faith, and by practice, eventually there's times, moments, really, when it all settles and something else starts to take its place. And that's what I'm sensing is the prajna paramita place.
Just to keep it more local or more physical, I would say, it might be good to just look at it at this stability, this kind of confidence or stability that can rest, that is willing to arrive or willing to rest, is based on a kind of what you might call a kind of balance. So stability itself is based on a kind of balance. So maybe we could ask what do we balance, or maybe balance is too big a word. Maybe what do we bring here?
Intention.
Or what do we align ourselves to?
Yeah. Attention, do you get?
Our attention.
Intention.
Uh-huh. Attention.
Intention.
Yeah.
In the normal way, though, right? Attention to intellectual pursuit, or attention in a way that's, and I notice it in my breath. A lot of times, when breath comes, just this first sitting, it's like I can drive on. And all of this, and I come here, and then it takes about 20 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice it in my breath. It's like it's an attention, but it's an attention that is not like I've normally done all my life, which is to, it's a relaxed attention. It's a paradox of attention in a way. Not attending, and yet attending, or something. Allowing.
When I was in art school, they trained us to, as far as drawing, to have what's called soft focus, or that kind of panoramic or comprehensive focus. So usually we just look at this and this and this and this and this, and we're doing this thing called image identification. So that's a person, that's a chair, that's a table. And we identify it and then kind of move on. And it's a But as far as drawing is concerned, we need to actually drop off that sense of image identification, that labeling of things, and just see a form. And sometimes see a form or a shape or a color or an area in relation to all the other areas. So we soften our focus or we relax our focus. It's still attention. But it's softer, or it's more spacious, or it's more comprehensive. I think you're talking about something like that. You're actually paying attention, but it's at ease, right? This is interesting stuff. Practice sometimes say initially to attend your breath as a kind of focal point. Sometimes my experience, I could say not all the time, but sometimes my experience is in a period of meditation, I have a kind of honeymoon period in the beginning where my attention to my breath is quite nice. It's quite good. I'm there. And after I've kind of enjoyed this simple rhythm of my breath and a kind of my arrival, then I don't know, kind of go wandering around, little trips or something, you know, and I get into some internal dialogue discourse in my head, and then toward the as the period evolves, I actually find that less interesting. Or come back almost with relief to my physical place and my actual sense of consciousness and notice my breath. But at that point, my breath or noticing my posture is held very softly, and it's almost like it's taking care of itself. Does anyone else have similar experience like that?
You've described very well what I've often experienced myself. I hearken back to something I read recently, which tries to crisply describe that in three words: stillness, occurrence, and recognition. And so the stillness is that space you get back to if you can recall to follow your breath. Then occurrence is something will bubble up.
Uh-huh.
And then recognition is the awareness that something had bubbled up and you're no longer on the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And my practice is to repeat what you just described to try to recognize a little bit more quickly and allow the stillness to last a little longer. And it seems to go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Repetitive.
What's your experience?
I think mine is kind of much a cycle where it's kind of, I've heard it referred to as crazy monkey mind, where it's just all thoughts popping up and, you know, and you kind of, you take your breath and then some more thoughts pop up and you kind of just gradually kind of get the crazy monkey mind settled down and then just, again, the awareness of the breath becomes much more easy for a while, where it's just a little bit more, it feels more centered, and then again that crazy monkey mind may start up again, and just kind of that catch and release of the
catch and release,
you know, but like, you kind of let it go.
I love that term. It's like, I used to fish with my father and my older brother when I was a kid, and we did catch and release sometimes.
It's the same with that. So it's sort of that's kind of how I find my meditation goes. And then it's kind of just that trying to, you know, like my knee will hurt, and I'll think, okay, just breathe through it, and then and that trying to kind of release that ego that's like my knee.
Mm. And, to know, see this phenomena.
Yeah, uh-huh. Just kind of,
not,
you know,
not my knee. Not my
right,
knee.
Right, yeah. Just kind of go back to sort of that present moment thinking where it's, you know, just try to forget that my knee has my ego attached to it. Oh, it's hurting. Oh, it's, try, you know, so
yeah.
Again,
it's your property. It's your knee.
Yeah, just kind of trying.
Why is it behaving?
Exactly. I just want to be, my mind should just be calm. I don't want my knee to hurt. So I think that's kind of how it goes, just kind of that, again, that kind of almost appearance and emptiness of, okay, it's my knee, but I don't have to really give it any more thought than that, and then it kind of calms down for a while, and again, just sort of that, I guess that's where I see that relationship between appearance and emptiness is sort of, I don't have to attach the ego to it,
I can just kind of let it be more just thoughts. And so I guess that's where the kind of that constant
mm-hmm. wave, wave. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. One thing I've been, my very original practice was koan practice, and my first koan was who am I? Which I think is a basic koan anyway, or a basic yeah. question. So I find that when my mind is doing the swirlies, I think, who is thinking? And every time sort of a thought comes up, I'm like, who's thinking? And it kind of brings me back to the basic question, who am I? Mm-hmm. Who is this? And who, what
you feel
is this?
And then you come back to your body,
come
to the place.
Come back to my body, to uh-huh. And to the question, which to me is what practice is about. It's not really answering the question, but it's the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who am I? What am I? What is this? Mm-hmm. So I just kind of ask, well, who's thinking? Or who's feeling the pain? Or who's hearing the sound? It's what I've been working with at the moment. So. And it's been very helpful to me. It just kind of seems to bring me back to someplace.
Monkey mind, or lots of thoughts, lots of thought production, is sometimes termed, when they talk about meditation, is sometimes termed, is that us already? Is sometimes termed 12:30?
Go ahead,
Judge. Is sometimes termed excitement, like mental excitement. Like so the sense we talked about balance in practice is like we're like a bird with two wings. We want to be balanced in our flight. So the other side of meditation is sometimes people sink in their meditation. They sink below awareness. Usually they say they're sleepy, or they get sleepy in meditation, or they might get dreamy or just spaced out, you know, trancy, spaced out, whatever. So has anyone experienced that?
It's happened a couple of times where I'm sitting there and all of a sudden I feel like I'm really, really big. Like I'm just spreading out to everything. It's the weirdest feeling. It's like, and I told Abijah, and he goes, that's marginal man. That's what he always called it. You know, like all of a sudden you just feel like all of a sudden I just feel like I'm just huge and I'm just part of everything. And I don't have this body here anymore. And it's weird. It's really, and then I'm like, what am I just, am I sleeping? Am I dreaming? And, you know, and I'm aware of the wall, and I'm aware of my body being really big. This only happened a couple of times, and I liked it. It was kind of cool.
Marshmallow. That's a new category for me. Marshmallow man.
But that's not the norm. But that's a couple of times I've had that experience. It was kind of cool.
I'm jealous. I want to be a marshmallow.
Sweet.
Yeah. What's your experience, Joel?
Today was...
You did calligraphy all day yesterday, didn't you?
Yeah.
Busy day.
I always have trouble with my back. I can't sit well. My back is always going... this collapses when I'm walking around. It's fine. It's just sitting. So I'm always coming back to the posture.
Me too. I'm spending a lot of attention. I'm sort of rebuilding my posture occasionally. When I'm sleepy, I something that works well for me is, or I notice that I'm getting dreamy or kind of just sinking a bit. I I actually deliberately tighten up my posture, and I tighten up the actual attention, the actual physical attention that I give to, say, my breath. I make that real strong or tight, and I even kind of stretch my eyes and make my, bring my neck in, and actually notice this, sometimes the sensation of my breath going into my nose, noticing those physical qualities, and even paying a little attention to my inhalation rather than my usually I pay attention to my exhalation and watch it all the way to the end, and enjoy that kind of gap at the end of the exhalation. But when I'm sleepy or dreamy, I pay attention to the inhalation and to kind of tighten up the whole mechanism of practice. And that usually, it's usually a good antidote for sleepiness. That usually brings me back. Does anyone do that? Do that same thing? Well, we figured it all out, haven't we? There's nothing more to do.
I would
forget about this. Let's move on.
Like, I'm such a loser with the meditation thing. Like, I feel so good in my practice, and I just love being here. I love everything that's going on. But it's like, why can't I get this better? So I'm really, really, this is great. This is great, Mike. Thank you.
Enjoy when you have thoughts. Mm-hmm. Be a good host to your thoughts, or like a maitre d' in a restaurant. When you notice that you're thinking, when you notice that your mind is wandering and you notice you're thinking, remember that you can think, you can breathe with anything. In other words, like your breath, you can still attend to your breath, but it can be breath along with the pain in your knee, along with your running thoughts. So you can think all you want with your breath. Let's put it that way. Okay? Try that.
My hope is this will continue at another time.
This is a big topic, isn't it? Practice discussion.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like we could all sit here and talk for a long time. Yeah.
But lunch is calling us, huh?
Yeah.